crises, tensions, a world divided. You had on one side, you had the triple entente, Russia, France, Great Britain. On the other side, the triple alliance. Germany, Austria, Italy. And as a result of dividing Europe amongst the great powers in alliances, all engaged in social Darwinistic activities, ultra-nationalism, all vying to outmaneuver one another, it was inevitable that tensions would rise. And of course, when nations have tensions, and tensions involve opposition, potentially could be war. We've already dealt with the tensions that were going on between England and France and Germany. Now we're in the Balkans. Tensions between Russia and Austria, and of course, Serbia. We dealt with the Pig War. We dealt with, well, actually, we dealt with the coup in Serbia, which changed things, the Pig War, and the annexation crisis. Now, we're going to deal with the last two crises that pushed that region closer and closer and closer. Two Balkan Wars. The first Balkan War was a war of the independent satellite states against their former empire. Montenegro, Serbia, Bulgaria, and Greece all made an alliance against the Ottoman Empire. Why? Well, there were still these lands here with the lines on it that were technically still part of the Ottoman Empire. The majority of the populations in those regions were Christians, so to a degree they fought a religious war. The Christians joined together against the Muslims to liberate their fellow Christians. And in the end, it was abysmal for the Ottomans. The Ottomans were quickly overwhelmed. Why? Well, truth be told, around the same time they started this war, the Ottoman Empire was also fighting Italy for control of Tripoli. So essentially, the Ottoman abilities were stretched to the limit. But in this war, tensions emerged because the expectation, particularly of Serbia, was that Russia would come in and help them essentially get the killing blow. But during the war, the Bulgarians, who technically were friends with Russia, became a little over-aggressive. While Russia did not get entangled in this war, they did send a warning. Do not occupy Constantinople. Do not take the capital city of the Ottoman Empire. Why did Russia do this? Well, yeah, you could sit back and say, well, Russia maybe wanted to take the city for themselves. Truth be told, the evidence that survived seems to suggest that Russia was hoping to use this to negotiate with the Ottomans the right to go through the Turkish Straits. But this suddenly put Russia on the other side against Serbia in the interests of the alliance. Why is this significant? Well, while everyone was paying attention to what was going on here, particularly with Constantinople, Serbia took advantage of the fog of war and sent its armies into this region over here, Albania, which during the war, the allied Balkan nations helped free from Ottoman control. But while they technically had independence on paper, they had no government, they had no army. So Serbia decided, well, if I can't get Bosnia and Herzegovina, I'm going to take all this left territory.
Of course, just by looking at the map, you can kind of figure out why.
Serbia here is completely landlocked, but if it could get control of Albania, it has ports on the Adriatic,
and thus can go out to the rest of the world. But ironically, the moment the Serbian troops entered in Albania, out of nowhere, the Austrians moved to block Serbia. They not only sent word to the Romanians and the Montenegrins and the Bulgarians, suggesting that Albania should be not only free and independent, but their independence should be guaranteed. They also say, why on earth would you allow Serbia to get access to the ports? To which all the other states said, yeah, that's right, the Serbs are kind of a pain in the butt. We don't want them to become more powerful. Then out of nowhere, Russia suddenly steps in and declares, no, the Serbians should get it. But when Russia declares its willingness to support Serbia, Austria threatens mobilization. They would threaten to go to war against Russia if they interfered in Balkan affairs. Apparently, the Tsar looked at mobilizing, but then he gets reports back from all his generals that the Russian army is too weak, so don't do it. So Russia once again steps in, promises, and then backs down. Knowing that they have no support, this outraged Serbia, but they were forced to withdraw. Because they knew they could not survive a war if Montenegro, Bulgaria, and Romania, and Greece made an alliance with the Austrians and attacked them. So, tensions ended. Crisis averted. For about 6 months. And then shortly thereafter, another war breaks out in the Balkans. But this time the teams changed. Because the Bulgarians were trying to scoop up Macedonia in most of these lands. Even though they didn't agree to that. The Greeks didn't want the Bulgarians on their border. The Serbians didn't want the Bulgarians to get more powerful. Neither did the Romanians. So all of the teams switch sides. In Greece, Montenegro, Serbia, Romania make an alliance with the Ottoman Empire and attack Bulgaria. It was a quick war. Bulgaria was quickly overwhelmed. And in the end, the Ottomans would get most of this land back. But why do I mention it? Well, simple. While everyone was paying attention to what was going on, over here, guess what Serbia again, while the war was going on? They said, oh, they send their armies back into Albania. This time, Austria sends Serbia a written ultimatum. If you do not withdraw and recognize Albanian independence, we will invade. Serbia looks to their friends Russia. Russia, can you help us? Russia doesn't even respond this time. Knowing that once again, for the fourth time in a decade, Russia has left them hanging, Serbia has no choice but to back down again, to pull its troops out of Albania, and to sit there all curmudgeoned. Why is this important? Because consequences. In 5 years, just 5 years, the Austrians have humiliated the Russians and the Serbians. They're winning. They're getting what they want. And needless to say, they wanted to keep the winning streak going. Russia abandoned its allies multiple times and got nothing out of it. Did not even get access to the straits. Again, in the first war, they were trying to play nice to the Ottomans. They got nothing out of that. And then the second time, they're just like, ugh. So when the Second Balkan War came to an end and they still did not get access to a warm water port, the Russians determined, you know something? Next time, we will be ready. Which means Austria is winning and they're aggressive. Russia is now angry and they're aggressive. Well, Serbia, rolled over by Austria, neglected by Russia, suddenly realized they were on their own. And if you're on your own, you have a tendency to be more aggressive. Because you are in a survival for your existence. Pumped up Austria, pumped up Russia, pumped up Serbia. All it would take is one little click. Just like that ding, to cause everything to explode. Questions? You got it? It's going to go away. Now, let's take us to this. Going back to where we began. June 28th, 1914. Everyone is pumped up. Feeling desperate. Feeling angry. Feeling aggressive. And one person died. June 28th. 1914, heir to the Austrian throne, Archduke Francis Ferdinand, was shot with his wife while visiting Sarajevo in Bosnia. Bosnia was technically an Austrian province, and Ferdinand was visiting to assess how things were going. It was a royal visit. So he would go review the army. He would go meet with the politicians. He would give a few speeches. And then he would go. Unfortunately, due to a series of really bizarre... I mean, you want to see something bizarre. Just how it got to the point where he got shot. Now, I'll be quick. All right. So there were six co-conspirators. Guys who were part of the Black Hand. And they were like, yeah, we're going to make a big political blow. Kind of like a big FU, you know, to Austria. That they can't bully us Slavs. They all arranged themselves on the street. And by the way, his itinerary was printed in the newspaper. So they knew down to the minute where he was going to be the whole day. So they take up their positions. The first guy, apparently, was flirting with a lady. So he didn't even notice the caravan goes by. The second guy chickened out. He saw the caravan coming. He's like, oh, I can't do it, and ran away. Third guy actually has her grenade, throws the grenade, but it bounces off the convertible top of the Archduke's car, lands in the street, blows up the car that was following the Archduke, which I think had police officers in it. Might have been soldiers. I don't remember. But when the explosion went boom, the Archduke's driver floored it, and race to City Hall. At which time, the fourth guy sees the car goes by, doesn't have a chance to get the gun out. The fifth guy and the sixth guy, same thing. So they had a chance and they blew it. But the sixth guy decides, after everything goes away, that he was hungry. So he went into a corner market to get a hero.
You know, those Slavic sandwiches,
Subway, Guadalupe Princip. So he goes into the little corner store, gets his sandwich, and by the time he comes out, who's in the alleyway turning around because the driver went the wrong way? But the Archduke's car. So he pulls out his gun, fires off a bunch of shots, hits the Archduke and his wife, and both of them would see him bleed out and die. But he was a member of the Black Hand, that terrorist group that couped the Serbian king. And the goal of this assassination was to pave the way for a Slavic revolution in which all of the minorities repressed by the Austrians would rebel, join Serbia, and create a pan-Slavic state. Of course, it didn't work. The assassin who threw the grenade attempted to jump into the river to swim away. But the problem was, is the river was really low, so all he did was end up in, like, basically knee-deep in mud. And the crowd went down and beat him almost to death. Same thing happened to Guarlo Princep. After his shots were fired, the guards, the police, descended upon him and beat him. Again, almost killed him. But he would be put on trial and found guilty of murder. Well, now what do you do? You get all the nations, all of the powers, all pumped up. Well, wouldn't you know it? Dang it. Kaiser contacts Austria and says to Austria, you do whatever you need to do to punish the Serbians. We're going to give you a blank check. What's a blank check? What does that refer to? Unlimited money, exactly. So I'm going to put your name on it. I'll sign it. But you put whatever you need on it. Even war. In fact, Kaiser's government encouraged Austria to not only take up arms, but to launch a quick war. Essentially, put everything you have into it and overwhelm the country completely. Do it before anyone else can react. But there was a problem. Because at the time of the assassination, the Austrian army, by law, was not on duty. Because during the end of June and into July, they have a holiday where the soldiers basically go back to their homes. Most of them were farmers, so they help the families harvest the crops. So at the worst time imaginable, Austria cannot respond right away. So it has to stall. Now, were they ready for it? It's possible they could have easily overwhelmed Serbia, and it would have been so quick, they could have then just negotiated afterwards. But they took their damn time. So how do you stall? Send an ultimatum. Ten things the Serbian government had to agree to within 48 hours. Do I expect you to remember them all? No, but I'll go through them all anyways because they're kind of wacky. The Serbian government basically had to censor its press. You couldn't allow any anti-Austrian stories to be published. Serbian government had to do something about the Black Hand. Arrest its members, prevent any more assassinations or terrorism. Okay, I can see that. But the Austrians said, no more teaching little Serbian boys and girls anti-Austrian propaganda. The government also had to agree to go through a sweep of its government, all of its employees, go through the army, go through its small naval forces. To basically remove any officer or soldier or teacher who has anti-Austrian sentiments. Then the Austrian government had to allow, Serbian government had to allow Austrians to come in to investigate, to verify if these things were being done. Plus, Serbia had to arrest anyone involved in the assassination. They actually named one person, Major Volja Tankosic, who was the leader of the Black Hand. He had to be arrested. Had to stop all weapons from going across the border. And had to share any reports, any anti-Austrian reports that Serbian officials were talking about, even if they were like ambassadors in other countries. And then my favorite of all the 10 points was the 10th. Let us know within 48 hours when all of these things are done. I'm sure when you were kids, maybe still, your parents give you ultimatums. Do this. But usually when mom and dad say do this, they give you a or what. They tell you the consequences. Guess what the Austrians didn't put in it? Sorry, I thought it said consequences, but I guess not. 48 hours to accept or nothing. Now, why did they not put consequences? I don't know. But from what I've read, the Austrian officials who wrote this made these things so ridiculous that they expected a rejection, because they would then take the rejection to justify military action. But you know what the Austrians didn't expect? The brilliance of the Serbian reply. Well, there's no specific consequences. There we go. So, you got these 10 separate things. And the way the Serbians replied was a masterstroke. They said to 3 points fully, yep, I'm on board. We're fine. We will do that. Then there were 6 that they said, okay, we agree, but you know, we're a little concerned. We have reservations. Of course, one of the things they agreed on to was to reply within, you know, 40 hours. Just FYI. They also agreed to arrest Major Tankosic. But as far as like suppressing the press, dissolving the Black Hand, they're like, look, okay, you know, censoring the schools, okay, we'll try. We'll try to do our best. But no promises. But the best reply was their only rejection. And that was the 5th point. Austrian officials coming into Serbia to investigate. Could you imagine if Donald Trump allowed the ambassador of Canada, the Prime Minister of Canada, to send police into our country to investigate something? Could you imagine Donald Trump doing that? And if you don't like the U.S.-Canadian option, what about if we were going to go and investigate, say, the drug cartels in Mexico? You think the Mexicans are going to allow us to go in and do that? No nation on earth would allow another nation just to come in. Because the other nation says, do this because I said so. But they didn't say that. In their reply, they said, we cannot agree to allow the Austrian officials come in because that would be a violation of our constitution, which allows for due process of law. In other words, if the Austrians were going to come in and accuse you of doing something and arrest you, where's your lawyer? Are you going to get a trial? Where's the evidence? Due process of law. So as the Serbs told the Austrians, no government has a constitutional right to violate its own constitution. Sorry. By doing so, they're appearing to be diplomatic. By doing so, they're trying to negotiate. But in doing so, they painted Austria in a corner. Because now what? Now what? Pretty reasonable. Not a single country on earth would have answered any differently. Thus painted in the corner, the Austrians had no choice, and they stupidly said, well, because Serbia rejected one, that's a rejection of the whole thing, so we're going to declare war to restore our nation's honor. Well, the moment the Austrians declare war on July 28th, the Serbians declare war. They're going to mobilize their armies. They're going to call in the reserves. They're going to put guns and bullets in the soldiers' hands. They're going to be positioning military forces and materiel. Well, as it was playing out on the big board, lo and behold, what happens? Well, in the Foreign Office in Berlin, Germany starts doing the connections. Wait, if Austria attacks Serbia, Russia might attack Austria. And under the dual alliance, if Russia attacks Austria, then we are legally obligated to attack Russia. And if we attack Russia under the Franco-Russian dual alliance, France is obligated to attack us. And then what about England? The Foreign Office quickly starts picking up the phone and firing off calls. First they call Austria and say, before you move into Serbia, you negotiate with Russia. Russia doesn't answer the Austrian call. So Germany, the Kaiser, actually called the Tsar, his cousin Nicky. And we're like, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. And the Tsar answered, fate is what it will be. So then Berlin starts calling France and tells France, you better back down. But what does France do? France calls Russia and gives Russia a blank check. The dominoes have begun to fall. Thus, we reach the point of no return. Do not write this down either, because I'm going to go quick. On July 28th, 1914, Austria declares war on Serbia. Serbia reciprocates and declares war on Austria. After receiving the blank check from France on July 30th, Russia declares it's mobilizing its troops. Germany, on July 31st, does another call to both France and Russia, demands that Russia ends mobilization and France declares neutrality. Both reject. On August 1st, Germany then declares war on Russia. On August 2nd, Germany announces to the world that it intends on going through Belgium to strike at France from the north. While England then responds and declares, if you violate Belgian neutrality, you are violating a treaty that we made back in 1839. Germany does not reply. But on August 3rd, Germany declares war on France. The same day, France declares war on Germany. On August 4th, England, for violating the treaty guaranteeing Belgian neutrality, England declares war on Germany. Germany declares war on England. On August 6th, Austria declares war on Russia. Russia. And then Serbia declares war on Germany. Then August 11th, we're now in week two, France declares war on Austria. England, on August 12th, declares war on Austria. August 23rd, Japan, who's an ally of England, declares war on Germany. And then the last major power to join in 1914 was the Ottoman Empire, coming into the war on November 1st, on the side of the Central Powers. Interestingly enough, the only nation that was involved in the treaties that did not move was Italy. Italy declared neutrality. Because under the Triple Alliance, Austria wasn't attacked. Germany was not attacked. No, they were the ones declaring war. So Italy said, no, we're not getting involved. But eventually, the Entente would entice Italy to come in. So on May 23rd, 1915, Italy would join the war against the Central Powers. Then October 14th, 1915, Bulgaria would join the war on the side of the Central Powers. And then the last major nation to join what would become the First World War was on April 6th, 1917, when these United States of America entered the war against Germany. This quote comes from British Foreign Minister Sir Edward Grey. When asked in August, as nation after nation is declaring war and troops are mobilizing and armies are building up and everything was going to go to chaos, the reporter asked, what is going to happen? And the foreign minister responded, well, the lamps are going all out over all of Europe. We shall never see them lit again in our lifetime. Of course, the greatest irony of this quote was that back in the annexation crisis, it was Sir Edward Grey who blocked Russia's efforts to get access to the Turkish Straits. So had he let Russia get that, you could almost argue that the war might not have happened. Questions? Now we've come to the big event in the class. The culmination of everything that we've talked about. Global expansion. Mercantilist expansion. Colonial efforts. Control of trade routes. Incursions into countries. Toppling of dynasties and regimes. New imperialism, racism, blah, 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 blah. Everything in global history would come together at one point. World War I. This was a war unlike any other war that had ever been fought in human history. This was a war that wasn't a war of maneuvers and occupation. This was a war aimed at the total destruction of your opponent. The goal was not just to beat your enemy, the goal was to destroy your enemy.
Now, of course, the irony is that's not what they expected.
They expected World War I to be like many of the wars that had happened before. Short and quick. A war of movement, where one army would basically outmaneuver another, and then you would quickly sit down at the negotiating table and maybe redraw some borders. But what they ended up getting was a war of attrition. Death on a massive scale, where both sides were trying to completely wipe out the opponent. Now, why didn't it end up quick, like the Franco-Prussian War, or the Crimean War, or any of the other wars that we've alluded to? Well, simple. You had on both sides great powers that had the largest armies on Earth at the time, that had the greatest military capacity, the strongest economies, the means to supply men from across the world and funnel them into the battlefront. And they were equal. So as they clashed, neither side could get an advantage. So it forced both sides to dig in.
They started making trenches on either side of the battlefield. Because if you did not put your men in trenches, you know, human beings, you may think you are invulnerable. But the truth be told is we as creatures, we go splat real easy. Particularly when, like, this is a Maxim machine gun capable of firing 300 rounds per minute.
And all of that hot lead comes at you. You will go real quick. So the only way to keep your men alive is to utilize other technology. Shovels, trenches, sandbags.
And then even though the men were in the safety of the trenches,
both sides had artillery, mortars. So you could fire bombs and basically hit the enemy even in the trenches, which caused the trenches to become more complex. So instead of fighting offensive maneuvers, both sides began focusing on defense, and they basically became implanted. And not only did the tactics change, but technology also changed at a lightning pace over the 4-year span of the war. Uniforms.
This is an artist's renditioning of what the French wore when the war started.
They went in there in wool coats and wool pants, red caps, red pants. Oh, geez, have a guy up in red pants with dark blue jacket on the horizon, he's going to be an easy target. But after the first year of war and tens of thousands, hundreds and thousands of casualties, the French basically said, yeah, we'll come up with a little interesting bit of camouflage.
This is horizon blue.
With these uniforms, if a French soldier was standing up, you really couldn't make them out from a distance because most of France is flat. So the person basically would blend up to the horizon. And helmets were adopted by both sides. Now the helmets were not bulletproof. The helmets were put on there because of shrapnel. Shoot a bomb over the enemy's trench, it blows up and chunks of hot metal comes flying down. It'd go right through a baseball cap. You also had the development of chemical weapons.
So how do you counter chemical weapons? Gas masks.
You also had a need to be able to get human beings across no man's land because of the splat factor.
This would cause primarily the Allies, but the Germans would do a little bit, to develop armored cavalry.
Because as human beings went splat, so did horses. By the way, interestingly enough, I believe statistically more horses died in World War I than human beings.
So, you put a man in a steel box and have that go across the battlefield. That'll be fine.
Oh, back in the day, you used to have your man march to the front. No more. Both sides used
railroad transportation,
allowing them to constantly not only move men in, but to reposition them along the lines.
And as the war continued, the factories continued to pump out more and more lethal pieces of technology. Chemical weapons. By the way, it wasn't just the Germans playing with chemical weapons. Both sides were. Actually, the French used it first. It was the French who first deployed tear gas on the Germans. So the Germans responded with chlorine gas. You all know what chlorine smells like. Well, if you inhale too much of it, the problem with chlorine gas is it basically burns your lungs, and you basically suffer from just having a chronic cough to asthma, and in some severe cases, asphyxiation. And once you get exposed to it, there's no treatment. There's no magic pill.
Well, tear gas, you could smell it, burns your eyes. Chlorine gas, you could smell it. So what do the French do? Well, the French counter with phosphine gas. Another chemical agent, deadlier than chlorine. But the key is that it smelt like grass. So once they released it, you'd smell and you couldn't smell it, which increased the likelihood of you being exposed to it. But of course, the only drawback was that you could still see the smoke. And so the moment you started smelling it, soldiers would quickly put on their gas masks.
And then that would cause,
the enemy, the Germans, to respond with mustard gas. And that was the worst of them all. Because unlike phosphine or chlorine, which you inhaled, mustard gas would contaminate the battlefield. So imagine if you're home and you're making cookies and you're using powdered sugar, and it just goes poof. That's essentially what would happen with mustard gas. And the chemical agents would remain active on surfaces for up to a week. So you might not even have been up in the front, but you get deployed up in the front and you come in and you put your hand in the wrong place and you wipe it to an eye. Well, it would immediately start to sting. It could possibly cause you to go blind. Or if you licked it and it got into you, internal and external bleeding,
including attacking your bronchial tubes.
And if you had an overexposure, you would suffer painfully for 4 or 5 weeks before you died. Brutal, horrific. But the moment the Germans deployed mustard gas, somehow the French and the English got the secret and they started doing it as well. Tit for tat.
Submarines.
Submarines were first invented by the British. They were used for reconnaissance.
But the Germans innovated and added torpedo tubes to them.
So they would use wolf packs of undersea boats, U-boats, and they would prey under the water and they would attack enemy shipping. Ironically, the Germans used submarine warfare so efficiently, they actually almost got England to surrender because they pretty much were cutting off food supplies from getting to England.
Airplane? Orville and Wilbur Wright invented the airplane. It was a toy.
But once the army got a hold of it, they realized, oh, we can put men up in the air, and they can survey the battlefield. They can take positions. They can see the enemy entrenchments. They can see enemy movement. We've already talked about tanks. This is a mother tank. That's what they would refer to it as. I think it's a male version, because the female version has machine guns on the side, where the male version has a big gun, and based on that gun box, I mean, that's what that is. But again, iron box, slowly go across no man's land. And of course, the most interesting piece of weaponry used in World War I, barbed wire. Invented by, here in America, by cattle ranchers to keep their herds in check. Well, both sides would put miles and miles and miles of barbed wire in front of their entrenchments. So as you tried running across no man's land, you'd get snagged up in the barbed wire. And then it would just be easy pickings. But of course, there was technology and tactics aimed at countering every Newton maneuver. So, you use gas. Your soldiers always have gas masks with them. Always. It becomes part of their kit. You have submarines, well, they started developing depth charges. Timed explosive devices that detonate at a certain point. And the problem with submarines, these big steel tubes that are held together with welds and rivets, if there's a force underwater, it could cause depressurization, which caused the hulls of the submarine to go, which would cause it to implode, and everyone's dead. Airplanes, oh, it's all good, look at me, I'm up in the sky, until they started putting anti-aircraft guns on hinges, and they started shooting flak rounds, like shotgun shells, because the planes, they were made out of wood and paper. Tanks? Oh, you know what the ultimate counter to a tank is? Right there, baby. The Germans deployed specialized shock troops that would go out into no man's land with flamethrowers. Why? Well, guess where the gas tanks were on the tanks? Yeah, they were outside in the back. So they would hide down in the craters. The tanks would basically drive right over them. And then they would stand up behind and just go, wah! Cause the tank to explode. And barbed wire? Well, that's the reason why before every single battle there would be massive artillery bombardments. They'd basically try blowing holes in barbed wire to allow the men to get through. So, every time one tactic was used, it would be countered by another tactic or technology, resulting in a stalemate. That makes more sense. Producing, that's what I was trying to say. And of course, the stalemate prolonged the war, which resulted in more casualties, which motivated the politicians to fight harder to end the war, which of course prolonged the stalemate, resulting in more deaths. And a greater willingness to try to win it all. Because soon they realized the only way to win was basically to wipe out the enemy. But if you have a brick in one hand, and you have another brick in another, made out of equal substances, and you start smashing them together, chips and chunks will start falling off of both. And in the end, you're just going to be holding small bits of rock.
Question.
Now, ironically, World War I actually, to be more precise, was, technically speaking, four wars in one. But we're going to focus on the big two theaters, because there were military operations in Africa, and there were military operations in Asia. But the two areas that got the most attention were in Europe. The most famous part of the battlefield is the Western Front.
the Germans raced through Belgium and penetrated northern France. At one point, they got close to Paris, only to be driven back. And as a result of German pressure and French and British counter-pressure, you had this 400-mile
boundary between the enemy encampments that went from the English Channel all the way to Switzerland, which was neutral.
On the Western Front, you had Germany, you had Austria fighting
against primarily England and France.
But of course, there was still a little bit of Belgium left. Not much.
On the Western Front, the strategy: find a weak point in the enemy's trenches. At some point, find a weakness. And then move your men close to the weak point. Then, once you have your men in position, you unleash artillery bombardments because you want to blow up all of the barbed wire that's in front. Actually, this is even better. All of this barbed wire here. And possibly put some holes in the outer trenches. Then, after sending tens of thousands, some battles, there were millions of rounds fired.
Then at some point, the officers blow a whistle, which is the signal for the men to race out of their safe points, their safe spaces in their trenches, and go over the top.
Once they're over the top, they are in no man's land. 200, 300, 400 yards that separate both sides.
And you have to run like hell from your position to get all the way over to the enemy side. And you hope, not only do you avoid all of the that's being fired at you, but you hope when you get over there, you actually land at a point in the line that has been hit by an artillery shell. Well, there is no enemy. Because if not, you come running over the top and the enemy's there, ready for you. If you're lucky, you're able to penetrate the enemy lines. You might be able to do some damage along the front ones. But the problem is there's just not a trench. There are actually usually three or four lines of defenses. So the moment the enemy gets word that you are in their trench, they're going to start repositioning men. So what do? You run amok in some of the front areas. You try to get intelligence. You try to get important documents. Maybe capture a prisoner or two. And then you have to quickly run out of the trench, run all the way back across no man's land before the enemy is ready to attack.
Now, the irony is, there would be some times when along a mile or two or three stretch of the trenches that you would do some serious damage and you'd push the enemy back. But it would only be a matter of days or weeks before the enemy is able to reposition and get back all of the land. Just like a pendulum. You move it a little bit to one side, but then suddenly it's going to come back. And then you push the enemy back, and then it's going to back and forth. Back and forth. And in the end, no land is really gained, and you suffer a horrific level of casualties. Now, the easiest example of one of the big battles of World War I was the Battle of Verdun.
Verdun was an ancient fortified city. It had a big old castle there that was a citadel. And in the years after the Franco-Prussian War, the French had made a bunch of gun emplacements, mini forts, around the city.
I think there was like 26 in all. No, I was wrong. 28.
So basically you have your city with your fortification and you have these rings of fortresses. So if the enemy is going to attack, you have these gun positions and you can shoot at the enemy.
Well, here's the thing. From 1914 all the way up until the end of 1915, the Germans never really attacked Verdun, despite its location. Here is the German line. And you can see when the next map comes up, it's kind of sticking on a corner. So it's kind of protruding. Which means the Germans can attack from three ways.
Well, because the Germans never attacked there for the first 2 years, the French had slowly begun moving troops out of Verdun and pulling artillery out of Verdun and moving it to other places where the Germans were attacking.
Well, once the Germans recognized this, beginning in around late October 1915, they slowly began preparing for the attack.
They, from all of these little towns, removed all of the civilian population.
They didn't want any spies.
They also brought in engineers that dug underground bunkers close to the perimeter.
They also marched in troops.
They built railroad lanes getting close to the line. And they began stockpiling artillery shells.
FYI, 600,000 men were moved into the area. And 1,200 artillery guns. In addition to the railroad tracks, they also laid telephone cables so you could have a network of communication.
The plan was to unleash a massive bombardment along an 8-mile stretch of the corner frontier to be able to hit it from three directions. And then once you pulverize the French defenses, then you penetrate. And you get into the interior. And you possibly seize Verdun and lock it off.
Now here's the funny thing. There was nothing of military importance at Verdun. But the reason why the Germans wanted to do it was Verdun was a place of pride. Because it's at Verdun where France as a country was made 1,000 years before. So this was a historic FU. Well, on D-Day, the German guns begin to fire for 9 hours. They fired close to 2 million shells. It was the highest rate of fire of the entire war.
Once they pound the French positions, the German troopers quickly race across the lines and begin making their way into French territory. In the first week, the Germans advanced 6 miles. But
they began to slow down and stall. From March to June, they were only able to move 1 more mile. Why? They put everything they had and they couldn't penetrate all of the defenses. So they ran out of steam. Now, by the way, not only was this meant to be a psychological blow against the French, things got so bad on the French side that as word spread up and down the line of what Germany was doing, almost the entire French army mutinied. They were almost willing just to give up and go home. It got so bad, the French generals put in an order that if any soldier disobeys orders, they're going to be shot on sight. But as the German advance bogged down, well, the French, thanks to the English, begin shifting men into their rear positions and begin moving them up. Soon, the Germans are outnumbered because the French have more soldiers there. And it is the French that begin slowly moving forward and pushing the Germans back. From July until December, the Germans would eventually give back every inch of land they occupied. And on December 13th, when technically the Battle of Verdun was over, Germany literally was back in its original places. From February to December, this battle raged, resulting in nothing but death. On the German side, 350,000 casualties. On the French side, 400,000 casualties. Nearly 750,000 men were shot, injured, or killed. This was the highest casualty rate of the entire war. And what did Germany have to show for it? There you go. Death. Now, the Battle of Verdun was the largest over-the-top battle. But every single battle from 1914 all the way up into 1918 was fought the exact same way. And what did it result in? Nothing but death. On the Western Front, in total, there would be 13 million casualties. Dead, wounded, disease. Men your age, guys. That's where you ended up. Roughly one out of every three soldiers who fought on the Western Front ended up in a grave. Most of them marked, but some not. Questions? Well, ironically, on the Eastern Front, it was a very different war. Very different war. Why? Well, very simple. The size of the front. When the war started, you can't look at the orange, this is cheating, this is what the map looked like at the end. But when the war started, you can see all the pink. This was the border in between Germany, Austria. Oh, I suppose we'll include Serbia as well. On the Western Front. Over 1,000 miles. Actually, close to 1,100 miles total. Front. So as a result of this massive frontier, trenches didn't really develop because there wasn't enough men to cover that distance. So lines were more like lines on the paper, and it was easier for an army to go over the line and back and forth. Fighting on this side, you can see the pink, Central Powers, Germany, Austria, Bulgaria, the Ottoman Empire, and they were fighting against primarily Russia and Romania. Not only was it vast and open, there weren't as many telephone poles. There weren't as many railroads. There were very, very few network connections. So literally, to get word from point to point, it usually resulted in a guy on a horseback. And of course, if you have a guy with information on a horseback racing along the lines, he could easily be captured or shot or killed. So what's the big deal? Well, if you're on the Western Front, because you have all the telegraph and telephone lines, the moment you know an attack is coming, you can begin repositioning men to fill the hole. Not the case in the Western Front. There was one battle in 1915 where the Russian army was coming in through what today is Poland. The German army essentially went by them, went around them, and the Austrian Empire kind of hit the Russians from the south. The Germans intended on hitting the Russians head on, but they completely missed them. Vast open terrain. But hands down, the most important feature of the Eastern Front was the fact that one of the combatants, Russia, was not prepared for this war whatsoever. Russia would deploy the largest army. When 1914 hit, they had 1.4 million men already in uniform. And would mobilize another 5 million more. About 6.5 million soldiers. But you want to know the funniest thing? In their arsenal at the start of the war, they only had 4.2 million rifles. So this essentially meant about one third of their soldiers went into the battlefield with no guns. So what did they have? Spears. Swords. Maybe they were lucky, had a sidearm. Oh, and if you know anything about firearms, not only did they have only enough guns to arm two thirds of their men, but in their army, their arsenal, they had over 20 different types of rifles. And if you know anything about firearms, every single one fires potentially a different type of ammunition. Plus, most of the guns were purchased from other countries. So where are you going to get your ammo from in the midst of a world war? Literally, men were ordered to charge across the battlefield, and whether you have a gun or not, when the guy gets next to you, gets shot, you bend over and you pick up whatever he has that you need. So if you have a couple of bullets and he has the rifle, well, you take his rifle and add your bullets to him. If you got the rifle and the guy next to you has a couple of bullets, well, you wait till enough of them with the bullets die, and then maybe you can fill your 5-round magazine. And on top of that, they had the most incompetent leadership out of all the armies. The Tsar, because he was born, had the right to be the commander-in-chief of the army. And all of the officers were nobles. But they didn't go to any type of military academies. They didn't know how to lead men into battle. They just were born with the right last name. I'm sorry. I'm kind of smart. I do know things. But I don't think I could lead armies into the battlefield. Nor do I think I want to. Plus, the Tsar constantly fired generals. If a general did something slightly off that the Tsar didn't like, you'd be gone. So you know what ended up happening? A lot of generals would undercut other generals because they wanted to get a promotion. It was insane. And as if that was not bad enough, they had an atrocious level of medical staffing. for every 10,000 casualties, they had one surgeon. So think about that. You get shot, you're bleeding out, you potentially could live, but you are the 9,996th guy in line. What do you think is going to happen by the time you get up to the doctor? So how on earth did they think they were going to win? Propaganda! We have the biggest army. We are fighting for the fatherland. So we're just going to charge at the enemy. And we're going to make them run out of bullets. And then we will win. Don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes. On the Western Front, there was nothing but slaughter. FYI, in just the year 1916 alone, just 1 year, Russia suffered 2 million casualties. 2 million men, your age, shot, injured, dead. Plus, another 500,000 men surrendered to the Germans or the Austrians and became POWs. So they started the war with 6.5 million. In 1 year, they lost a third of their fighting capacity. And as if that was not bad enough, Russia suffered from a catch-22. The soldiers were mostly peasants. The peasants made up of about one-third of all able-bodied men in Russia. So the more peasants you kill, the more able-bodied men you have. And if the peasants are in the job of producing food, when you don't have them in the fields producing food, what happens to food production? You have no food. And when you have no food, supply and demand, prices skyrocket. So much so, the common people can't afford to buy bread for the kids. And eventually, what we're going to see in next class? Well, eventually those tensions would culminate in revolution. But as far as the Eastern Front goes, in the end, it would be even deadlier than the Western Front. Over 16 million casualties. 6 million lost by the Central Powers, 10 million on the Russian side, plus another 2 million civilians. And here is the last clip. Spoilers. It was because of what was going on the Eastern Front that Russia would suffer in the midst of the war a revolution. And that's what we'll pick up when we come back on Thursday. So, Papers. They're starting to trickle in. They are due by 11:59 p.m. If they do not come in before 11:59 p.m., that's when the late penalty will begin accruing. But if you looked at the penalties, you only have so many days because eventually you run out of points. All right?
How many is like the first day?
I think 5. Good luck.